You're listening to The Hudson River, a weekly half-hour program about the nature, culture, and beauty of one of America's great waterways. The Hudson River is produced at Vassar College and brought to you in cooperation with this radio station. I'm your host, Mark Breslov. Coming up, we speak with Dr. Robin Bell of Columbia University's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory about the mapping of the Hudson's bottom, which has led to the discovery of numerous previously unknown shipwrecks. We revisit historical folk singer Rich Balla and hear his rendition of the Adirondack lumberjack song, Joubert Jou. And we listen to sounds from Blue Ledge in the Hudson River Gorge, which is known for whitewater rafting and magnificent Adirondack scenery. All this and more next on the Hudson River. On this week's Hudson River Culture segment, we speak with historical folk singer Rich Balla about an Adirondack lumberjack song called Joubert Jou.
Now that's an interesting story. That was collected from a fellow named Yankee John Galusha by Frank and Ann Warner. And it's a song from the lumber camps of the upper Hudson Valley. And it was originally a song about a steamboat disaster on the Great Lakes. And at some point, you know, lumberjacks heard it and they kind of changed the verses and the lyrics, and it became a lumberjack song about driving the logs down the Hudson River to the sawmills at Glens Falls. The title of the song, Joubert Jou, is French-Canadian. A lot of French-Canadians work the lumber camps up there. And it's a French-Canadian expression, basically a derivation of the French words jour pour jour. And it means day by day, little by little, inch by inch, step by step. And that's the story behind Joubert Jou.
John Galusha was a boatman for 16 years or more. He crewed the Hudson River where the thundering waters pour. He did not fear no danger while in his own canoe. He'd run the Hudson River and the Indian River too. So watch her, catch her, jump her, Joubert Jou. Give her the wind and let her go, Yankee John can shove her through. You ought to heard him hollering as he went a-floating by, with a face the color of snow, boys, and blood red were his eyes. It was on a Sunday morning, just about the hour of 10. Yankee John and his boat crew, their business did begin. He rammed his boat against the jam and split her bow in two. And soon she filled with water and she washed away the crew. So watch her, catch her, jump her, Joubert Jou. Give her the wind and let her go, Yankee John can shove her through. You ought to heard him hollering as he went a-floating by, with a face the color of snow, boys, and blood-red were his eyes. Well, I guess she'd done some business that kept him busy there, for he did a perfect somersault as the bow stood in the air. Now the water swift and nimble from the jam she swept away, and spite of all that John could do for the sellers, she made way. Well, he begged the crew chief all the spring to let him run the boat. I guess he got his fill of her when from him she did float. Now his boat lay on the bottom and her riggings cast away. John's breaking jams along the shore for a dollar and a half a day. So watch her, catch her, jump her, Joubert Jou. Give her the wind and let her go, Yankee John can shove her through. You ought to heard him hollering as he went a-floating by, with a face the color of snow, boys, and blood-red were his eyes.
On this week's Hudson River feature, we speak with Dr. Robin Bell, Senior Research Scientist at Columbia University's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory. Bell heads an undertaking to map the bottom of the Hudson River for the first time since the 1930s, which has led to the discovery of numerous previously unknown shipwrecks. She begins by telling us what she's doing and why.
what I am doing is I'm working with a team of scientists, people from Lamont and people from SUNY Stony Brook out on Long Island, to make the first new maps of the bottom of the river since 1930. And the big difference is that we're using sound. Instead of in the 1930s, they actually used, you know, ropes with heavy weights on the end. So that our goal is to get a three-dimensional image of the bottom of the river and make habitat maps and maps of where the contaminants that have come down the river are.
You've been quoted as saying the process has been like going to your grandmother's attic and thinking it was full of junk and finding in actuality that it's a museum.
Well, my background is before working on the Hudson, I spent the last 15 years working in Antarctica, and there you're pretty sure everywhere you turn you're going to find something new or different or exciting. We found things like volcanoes exploding underneath the ice sheet or giant lakes. So when I started working on the Hudson, my preconceived notion that it was going to be sort of muddy and flat and boring everywhere. That's kind of what it looked like every time I pulled up my anchor from my boat. But it turned out that everywhere we looked, the bottom of the river had treasures. It was kind of like your grandmother's attic, where you think you go up and it's just these dusty old boxes. But you start opening the boxes and there are treasures inside.
How can this help the resource management of the Hudson?
If you were to look at how to manage the river based on what we knew, say, before this project started about 5 to 10 years ago, when you ask somebody what the bottom of the river looked like, they'd roll out one of these maps, the same maps that sailors use to get around, and they're usually a couple colors. There's, you know, white and blue, and there's lots of little numbers all over it. And that really doesn't tell you very much about the bottom of the river. Some places there might be a little S that says sandy or an RK that says rocky, but that doesn't give you a sense of what the bottom of the river's really like. And as people began to worry more about how the PCBs released in the upper river were transported through the river, or how the fish that inhabit the river, what their lifestyle was really like, you know, what were their homes like, people began to realize that they could take the technologies that scientists from Lamont had been using for decades to map the bottom of the ocean and use them to map the bottom of the river, in essence using sound and how strongly sound bounces off the bottom to tell you what the bottom's like. So what we hope to end up with when we're all done is a map that tells you both where the contaminated sediments are in the river and also where different habitats are, where it's sandy, where it's muddy, where there are giant sand waves moving down the river, or where it's sort of a quiet, peaceful place where mud quietly settles. And those will make very different habitats and very different places for creatures to live.
What is a sand wave?
A sand wave is what much of the upper river is characterized by. Much of the river, say from Kingston north, looks more like what you'd imagine the Sahara Desert to look like, and that there are sand waves that are on the order of 6 to 9 feet tall that extend, probably a third of a length of a football field, and they just paint the bottom of the river, and they move. We found out that we go back from year to year. They actually move a couple feet every year. So you actually have big migrating fields of sand waves.
Wow, and that would seem, if you think about the 1930s charts, nautical charts, they're not showing that, and that could make a big difference, no?
Yes, it would. I mean, that we find that there are places where it's very different between the 1930s charts and the depth measurements we've made now. As you can see, places the river that have gotten shallower and some places that are actually deeper.
Can you elaborate on the benefits of taking this relatively new ecosystem approach to the management of the river?
If you were to say that you wanted to preserve and better manage the elephant herds in Africa, besides figuring out how many elephants there were, one of the very first things you would do would be to get a satellite image or a map of the topography or maybe even aerial photographs of the region that you're interested in. as the state and as other institutions are interested in preserving the ecosystems in the river, not knowing what the base map looks like is a very fundamental hindrance to actually being able to look at the system holistically. So that's, in essence, what we're after, is the being able to put together the basic understanding of what's it like down there.
On the website, I saw the Institute of Ecosystem Studies mentioned, but they're not currently involved in this part?
Oh, they are. One of the questions that came up when we finished our first set of maps, which are in essence the geologic maps for the bottom of the river, was, does that mean anything for the critters that live in the mud? So what Dave Strayer at the Institute for Ecosystem Studies and another scientist at SUNY Stony Brook are doing is going out and looking at where we say that there are different bottom types and seeing if that matters for what kind of creatures they capture when they sample there. So that's work still in process.
And are you mapping only, or are you also taking bottom samples?
As I like to say, you don't really want to believe everything we geophysicists say based on our sound. We are fairly confident that we know what we're talking about, but what we do with the state support is we get both cores, which are in essence taking a long tube, a PVC tube like you might find in your bathroom with a heavy weight on it, and dropping it down in the river, and that way we can look back through time. And we also have this thing that looks like a frying pan that we send down, and it scoops up or grabs pieces of the bottom. And that way we can verify what we see with the acoustic methods we're using and make sure that we aren't making it all up.